Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Esther.
Hey, Jane, how you doing?
I'm all right, how are you?
Yes, well, I'm all right, and I'm so excited because we've got Lush. Oh, we're lucky to have Lush on the podcast.
Lush of the bath bomb. The sparkly bath bomb is my favourite. Anyway, introduce our guests, Esther.
Today, we've got Mark and Simon Constantine from Lush. Can you introduce yourselves, fellas?
Yeah, I'm Mark Constantine. I'm the boss of Lush at the moment. And in fact, Simon is not working for Lush at the moment, are you?
No, I'm Simon Constantine, and I am actually a finder of Carey's Secret Garden. That's how I'm putting it.
Right, that's very nice. Mm. Yeah, and so Simon did work for Lush for a long time, and obviously we're father and son.
And they aren't in a sort of magic factory, but the house in the Zoom picture, they do look like they're in a very nice house.
I think where we're sat used to have a kind of, it wasn't fully legal.
No, I went 7 years with no planning permission. So pleased with myself.
Kitchen, which made, so there were big, when I was a kid, I was a toddler, there were big pans of soap and moisturiser bubbling away where we're sat right now.
Yeah. Oh, really? So it was just like a sort of big kitchen of cosmetics.
Well, there were two, there was ourselves in here, and then my colleague Carl, who still works with us, he was in the shed.
In the magic shed that my mum, that's where the bath bomb was invented.
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
And did you know when you say that word, the bath bomb was invented, you know, because it really was invented with Lush, but was there like an explosion? You thought, hold on a minute.
Well, no, it was very straightforward. Yeah. It was what we wanted to do. I always think people, I mean, like yourselves, you see Lush as a very exciting, vibrant business, but we're quite earnest behind the scenes. So it's a little bit like a production, you know, like a TV production or a radio production, where it may come across very light, but you're working quite hard on it behind. What we were talking about, there were a group of us talking about urinary tract infections in under 7-year-olds is what we were actually discussing, and their liking for bubble baths and the problem that the bubble bath broke down the urinary tract so that it could soak up water. And we wanted to have something that was as much fun for children but wasn't a bubble bath. Well, of course, needless to say, we sell far more bath bombs to adults than we do to children. But that was the original start. And then we molded some Alka-Sizzlers, they were called, yeah, which were lavender-based bath bombs. And they were the first ones.
Yeah. And guess who they tested them on?
Yeah, but you didn't get a urinary tract infection.
No, I've got very pleasant memories of going to the toilet.
Yes. So instead of testing on animals, they tested on the sun.
Yes, well, that is the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know what? So how many years was that? Where was the first shop? Because I think my friend actually worked in the first shop.
Central London, would that have been?
Yeah, that was it. And was it in Covent Garden, the first?
Yes. So, well, we basically started down here in Poole, which is where we live. And then our first little shop was a tiny, tiny shop in Covent Garden.
Yeah.
You know the bit in My Fair Lady where she runs up the flower barrow and it's all set there. That shop is the spot where she...
Oh, really?
And yeah. I've got a bit of a thing about her. So that I really loved that shop. But it was very, very tiny. It was only really room for one person behind the counter.
Two post boxes in there.
Yeah, two people in front, really. Yeah. And that really, you wouldn't have recognised that as Lush. And then the first really proper shop was in King's Road. And that was the shocking. That was when suddenly we did everything that we're sort of better known for, the fresh masks and the bath bombs laid out like fruit. And that created an immense stir. We used to have about 1,000 people a month asking us for business. That's separate from customs.
What year was that then?
Oh, well, that, do you know what year it was?
No, well, it must have been
23 years ago, something like that.
So it was sort of 97, was it? Or 95?
That was a bit around then, wasn't it? Because yeah. 94, 95.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fairly soon, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, it was within a couple of years, wasn't it?
Yeah. Ooh. I mean, we didn't have any money, so it was quite, we had to get a backer to do the King's Road shop. Well, we had a backer to do the Covent Garden shop, really, as well.
And then you soon started to open other branches.
Well, people kept asking to do business with us. We were planning originally to just be in the M25. We'd had a business collapse. We didn't really want to do much. Mm-hmm. And so we weren't planning to do all that stuff. But all these people kept coming and telling us they wanted to do business with us. And we kept telling them to no, you know. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, I think the first guy we said yes to was Joe from Zagreb. He was nice. A lot of the time it was just, did we like them? We'd just go in the King's Road, we'd just go in the cafe next door and have a chat. And if we liked them, we did business with them. But a lot of Americans couldn't work out why we chose Croatia first. We had all sorts of interesting people. Adam Faith was very, very keen. He was keen on business.
In those really? Days.
Yeah, he invited myself and a friend to dinner with him. We went to dinner with him because he was very into business, you know, and then he started his dinner already because his friend's birthday. So we went in and he introduced us to his friend. And he said, have you met Eric before? And it's Eric Clapton. And he's like, well, no, we haven't. How'd you do? Happy birthday.
So,
and then Dustin Hoffman used to come in quite a bit. And then, Paul Weller. Paul Weller used to like the Guildford shop. He used to hang around in there and make tea for the girls. Yeah, so we used to get a lot of that going on in those very early days because there were only a few shops anyway. There was Guildford, King's Road, Covent Garden.
You know, you were really ahead of your time, weren't you, back then? And it was...
Well, I think the key there was that we had worked for a long time for the Body Shop making all their products. And had we had the expertise when we started with them, what we did would have been them. Do you see what I mean? So what we did for us as Lush, that was the progression in a way, almost like Body Shop 2, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but we'd finished working with Body Shop by then. So we did it for ourselves. But that, you know, so stripping all the packaging away, because, I mean, they did a lot to drop packaging levels, yeah?
Yeah, of course.
But to actually take it away completely, 100% recycled plastic bottles and so on, that was very much our style. What happens with product innovation is it's a very slow process. It creeps along at a steady pace. And it's only if we don't show you something for a bit and then suddenly show it to you that it suddenly becomes, oh, look at that. You know, we had quite a lot of those things for a long time.
Shampoo bars was a similar thing.
Shampoo bars, I mean, well, shampoo bars is the classic example, isn't it? When were they invented? Can you remember? Is it 87?
I thought it was 86, 87. By
the time they became successful, the patent had run out.
25 years later.
25 years later, suddenly everyone's like, these are a good idea. Oh, good. I'm glad you like them because, you know, they've run out of patent now. Not that it makes any difference for us. You know, it's nice when people get going. What I was going to explain to you when I was talking about these progressive ideas, if you take our skincare, we've been working on skincare for, well, always, right, from the very beginning. So this is 40 years because we were making products before. And Helen Ambrose, who's someone that Simon and I have worked with for a long time, she's been sort of slowly tightening things up. And then what's really lovely from the beekeeping point of view is that we've used biomimicry. Now, I can remember when you taught me that term.
At least you can remember something.
Yeah. So what we did, you see, people want product that lasts. They want face creams that last. But the problem is, to make them that last, you have to put preservatives in. You have to put the safest preservatives you can find. Now, in our case, we believe the safest preservatives we can find are propyl and methyl paraben. Yeah. Now, they're not always popular, but that's because preservatives aren't very nice. You don't really want them. You don't want them in the system. You don't want them in the water. You don't want them anywhere if you can avoid it, because they're poisons. They're there to stop microorganisms growing in the product, so that you just put this poison in. And then when you put it on your skin, that obviously controls, you've got a natural microflora, not exactly bees crawling all over you, but you've got a natural microflora, right? Which when you put the preservative on, it damages. So how do you get a preserved product that doesn't do that? And then you come to bees. You think of the bees when they're gathering the nectar won't last the winter. Yeah. So they have to drive the water off. Mm-hmm. They drive the water off and get the water level to a point that the honey will last the winter, mm-hmm. and then nip out in the spring or in the late winter and get the water to bring it back to dilute the honey to be able to drink it, because they can't drink the honey. Mm-hmm. We did the same thing with the moisturizers. That's what we've been doing all that time. So we've been copying honey by getting the water levels to the right level, that we can have self-preserving products, products we make that don't go off but don't need preservative.
Amazing.
It's very quick to describe, but that is Helen Ambrose's lifetime work.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. You have to make a lot of stuff, do a lot of tests, have a lot of stuff go wrong. Yeah, do it again. And that goes on and on and on. And so that, you know, those sort of things, they're much more behind the scenes and secret and not understood.
Did she actually follow what the bees were doing to try and think of that?
That was much more Simon and I, probably, from our angle. I mean, I haven't always been a beekeeper. I mustn't say that, because I haven't.
No, you shouldn't say that.
Should we describe our beekeeping experiences too?
Oh, yes, definitely.
So I started... I was quite an excitable young man, and I tried yoga and things like that, right? They didn't do much for me. So I decided that the way that I was going to calm myself down was I was going to keep bees, because if I moved too quickly or behaved in an excited manner, I'd get stung, right? And I apprenticed myself to a lovely guy called Dave, who was ex-Navy, and he had about 100 hives, and I would go out every Sunday with him and learn the craft, you know, which was good fun. I mean, it was very, very nice to do.
I do remember Dave, the beekeeper, coming round.
Yeah.
And taking you off places and stuff.
And playing his...
Because he was ex-Navy, he used to reminisce. So he used to bring tapes of people getting piped aboard and then play them to me. I was about 8. He used to play them to me.
Yeah. I'd like them. It was a very old-fashioned way of learning, because he'd been a boy's seaman. One time, for example, it was Sunday morning, right? We had quite a lot of hives to go through. He was older, I was younger. So he would pass me, and they were under trees, he'd pass me the comb to have a look, to see what the egg-laying pattern was like, and I would make a comment. And then he would pass it to me if they're incipient queen cups, and I would say whether I could see an egg in it. Well, one time he was in a hurry. He was obviously getting close to his lunchtime. And he passed me the frame, and there was an incipient cup there with an egg in it, right? So I said, there's an egg in there. So he took it off me brusquely, and he looked in there, and he said, that's just a bit of wax, and he quickly squashed it. So then a minute later, he's passing me a comb to look at the pattern of egg laying. And I said, well, there's no eggs in here. So he said, what do you mean there's no eggs in there? I said, well, there's just lots of bits of wax. Anyway, he didn't say anything, right? Didn't say anything, put it all back. And we put the hive back together. We're walking away, and I've got a bee in my hat. And I don't know with you too how you work with a bee in your hat, but I told him in the hope that he would just kill it, because it was going to sting me and I didn't like it. And so I said, I've got a bee in my hat, Dave. I've got a bee in my hat. And so he looked and he said, it's all right. It's only a drone. Now, your listeners will hopefully know that drones don't sting you. So I relaxed, and then it stung me. And that was very typical of the lessons I would get from Dave on a regular Sunday morning. And I would get quite badly stung occasionally as well. But he taught me all that sort of basic stuff, that you look after the apprentice. If you have an apprentice with you, you take the stings, not him, and so on. So he was quite traditional in the way he worked, that we worked the bees. And then I got my own bee shed down the bottom of the garden here. Where I had a little semi-detached house nearby where I used to keep bees, but you all know it's not good news to let people know you're keeping bees in the garden.
No.
So I had a little bee shed. and this bee shed was great. But then I had to move. This is not a good story.
God, are you sure you want to tell it?
Yes. Well, it's not in my favour because, well, it sort of, there's an echo shortly with my beekeeping with Simon, which we've been doing. So I'll just tell this story anyway. So basically, had this bee shed in a semi-detached house, sold the house, I had to move the bees. And as you know, they orientate themselves to a place in space, don't they?
Yeah.
And so I had to get the sheet. So I had my friend Jeffrey, who was my apprentice. I don't drive, right? I had his car there ready to take the bees, three hives to take out. Put the sheet in front of the first hive. He and I, I'd been drinking.
Oh, dear.
It was a stormy night.
Oh, God.
I didn't put all the equipment on.
Oh, God.
But I had my friend Jeffrey with me, and I thought it was going to be fairly straightforward. I thought we'd just ease it out, the hive, pop it in front, all would be well. Yeah. The lady of the house that had bought the house was now stood in the little conservatory watching all this going on. She couldn't really see much because the shed was on the back of the house. Anyway, pulled it away from the wall. They boiled out. They went bonkers. Jeffrey was all right, but of course, then I'm holding the hive and I'm saying to him, run, run, you know, and they are absolutely going bonkers. They're really cross. Managed to stagger out holding this hive past the lady who's looking from inside the thing, put it on the thing. And then I'm chased up the path by them, picking up, I don't know, 50 slits of things, I suppose.
Oh.
It was just an absolute mess. So then I left the hive. I got the hive, the one I'd moved in front where it had to be to still collect the bees as they came back. Told the lady not to go in a garden. The next day I went to see Dave. Dave, I've made this awful mess. I had an apprentice. I pulled the hive. I didn't have my proper boots on. I'd had a drink or two. They were all clustering. You know how they cluster around your mouth where I'd been drinking red wine? They were all clustered around there. Having a little go, yeah. Well, having a look, and that smells sweet. Oh. What's that? Anyway, I said to him, can you come and help me? So he says, yes, tomorrow, if both of you are there in your gear, with your hats on, smoker ready, boots on, wait for me there. I'll be there at 5 o'clock. He arrived at 5 o'clock. The lady was back in the little spot again, yeah, to see the fun, because she'd seen it yesterday and it was good fun. And then she was waiting there. Jeffrey and I, my friend, we were stood like two, you know, flower graders in white, you know, with the hat and the whole thing. He came in, no gear on, no boots, no gloves, nothing. Just a blue anorak. And then he said to the lady of the house, can I have a bowl of water, please? And so she gave him a bowl of water. And he just flicked the front. They all went in. He said, there, they think it's raining. Put the stuff in the front. Take it away.
How amazing. Did you know that you can do that? Make them think it's raining.
Well, I mean, well, I have tried that, but obviously that was a lucky one for him, wasn't it?
Well, I hope it was lucky. I mean, I like to think it was just lucky because I felt all right. Twit. So a lot of that, when you're asking, so with the formulation, for example, obviously, you know, learning from Dave and learning all of the bee stuff myself, I understood fully those aspects of honey and the way it was naturally preserved. And that helped because I work alongside Helen. So Helen did the bulk of the work, but I provided the, you know, the beekeeping impetus, really.
You're going to say.
No, you go on, go on.
But I was just going to, you know, because it's all free from animal testing, isn't it, your products. Yeah. But how easy is that to do? Is it, I mean, because there's so many other products on the market that are, that do use animal testing, is it kind of is it a big sort of ball ache to do it the other way around?
I mean, the truth is, imagine if the four of us were discussing making a nice range of honey face creams, yeah? And you said, now, how will you test them for safety? And I said, well, I'm going to use mice and guinea pigs. you'd automatically say, have you got anything better than that, Mark? Because that doesn't sound very thorough, does it? Do you see what I mean? You know, that was always my problem, that I didn't feel that created safety. While there's a moral position about not wanting to do things to animals for cosmetic sake, but from my point of view, I didn't see it was giving safety to people anyway. But we're back now. We're back now fighting animal testing in Europe. So when you think that most people would hope that they never have to think about that again, we're back to major fights where we're having to really go
for it. Well, the difficult part is the focus is always on the cosmetic, wasn't it? So yeah. It was the finished product being tested on an animal was the big focus. It's like, is that necessary? Is there more modern tests? Can't science catch up? That sort of stuff. And that's where the battles are won. And then they moved. It felt like the goalposts got moved back a step, which is, okay, cosmetic stuff's over here. Here's all the raw materials that go into your cosmetics. Now they need to be tested. And it doesn't, I don't know, you know, I'm not a scientist, but in terms of the information that's available, you think surely there are more modern and kind of humane.
Which there are.
Yeah, versions of that, which is where Lush puts a lot of its time and energy now.
We ran a Lush prize. Can you remember the first one?
I actually can't. It was over 10 years ago, isn't it?
It's 10 years this year.
There you go.
10 years this year. What we decided was it wasn't enough to just not test ourselves. We should make an effort. So we started a Lush Prize where we give prizes to scientists for developing non-animal tests for cosmetics and other things. Mm-hmm. And we give $250,000 a year in prize money. So it's a big prize. And that has been really successful. They've just done the judging last week, I think, this year. So that's very exciting and suddenly become pertinent again, you know. And we've got various scientists that we work with where they've really developed lovely tests, you know, really, really sophisticated tests that tell you a lot of stuff. Because it's mainly interesting if something causes cancer or, you know, the two main killers are heart disease and cancer. So they're things you want to know about. Do you know what I mean? And those sort of materials now are much easier to test than they were. You know, that might cause you some danger. Colours, hair colours, things like that.
I was just happy because you don't have to test on...
on you anymore.
Yeah.
Which I did test a lot on you, especially sunscreens. Do you remember all that? A lot of rubbing things on him, yeah.
But if you're using natural products, then you wouldn't think that they would have been...
Well, they have a long history of use. So honey, for example, long history of use. But still, you know, natural things can be dangerous in the same way as anything else, as we know. You know, I mean, I was thinking of monkshood or down by where we're keeping bees now. We've got quite a lot of...
foxgloves and things.
Yeah,
so you wouldn't, you know, those things are a concern, aren't they? So, no, I think you should always be alert and aware. And there are some really safe synthetics out there that are okay. But the nice thing about nature when you're using... Well, if we just talk about honey, you think how long people have been applying honey to their skin. You know, we really pretty much know what goes wrong with that. Yeah? Which is not a lot.
Sticky.
Yeah. Hard to wash off. Wouldn't want it. Well, I've got a great shampoo, which is predominantly honey. So that is a surprise, really, that makes the hair so beautiful. I suppose not a surprise, but, you know, you would think it would leave the hair sticky, but it doesn't.
And how do you do that sort of conscientiously, taking honey from bees for cosmetic products?
Well, this is the interesting thing. We're pretty much down now in Lush. We are a vegetarian company, not vegan, right? But we've always served vegans and we've always done a lot of vegan product. And you've experienced quite a lot of going and seeing them harvest honey.
Well, yeah, one of the roles that I had at Lush was head of ethical buying. So we had, you know, had a lot of these kind of conversations around ingredients and the ethics. Eggs went on for a long, long time
We cut them out now
because we used a lot of eggs at one point.
I read about that on your website. I was amazed that eggs were used.
Yeah, and so
Think of egg and lemon shampoo.
Eggs are very full of goodness, aren't they?
Yeah, protein, but the ethics of producing them, it just, you know, gradually it just became non-viable, didn't it, really? Discussing. But I think bees are kind of, I don't know, I mean, like for me personally, I wouldn't say draw a line in the sand because you can't be that firm on it, but there's definitely a place for beekeeping in the modern world, I think. I think that for me, they're, you know, they're they're great indicators of the health of your ecosystem, because they have to forage indiscriminately across all of the different, you know, whether, you know, where you're harvesting from. And there's great projects out there, ethical projects that you can work with. So a lot of the honey we're describing there, and that shampoo, for instance, comes from Zambia or from other fair trade community projects elsewhere. So yeah. Sometimes they're kind of one of the only viable lines of income for communities, you know, who don't have a lot of opportunity to do other things. So for me, you know, I got to travel around a lot and see a lot of these different things, and you think actually bees can provide a real lifeline where there's very little else to gain income from. And then, like you said, there's that debate, you know, about what do you put it into a product or do you eat it? Bear in mind that your skin is quite a big organ. I think people forget that you're still, when you're feeding your skin, you've got to watch out what you're putting on that as well. So I think that makes a big difference as well.
And it's interesting, isn't it, how, you know, the best, you know, like you're talking about Zambia, and, you know, a lot of the best beauty products have got like wax from places like that because they're less polluted. The wax hasn't got pollution or, you know, in like, I don't know how good my wax would be in Crouch End. It'd
be lovely.
To make a face.
I don't know how much pollution is actually held within the wax. Hardly any, I think.
I'm interested in that, yeah, because it's like, what? Mm. Where do they forage, you know, for resins and for waxes, where do they forage for it? Where do they get it from?
When I first was working with Anita Roddick in the body shop, I made a product called Honey Beeswax and Almond Oil Cleanser. And at first, because she only had one shop, I could do it all from my own bees, right? But I used to just take the cappings off. So basically, I had the honey for myself. But I took the honeyed cappings off, and I made the product from the honeyed cappings with almond oil. And so the beeswax was really not very clearly, you know, it was part beeswax and part propolis and part dirty feet.
You should wear boots.
That's so funny. Yeah. Yeah.
She never minded. Anita never minded. And that went on for several years.
That's like, do you remember Pete saying about, he dropped a whole, so one of our colleagues and friends, he keeps bees. And he dropped a whole, he was asked to somebody's house who had bees in the chimney, and he went up into the chimney and he displaced them very successfully, but he didn't catch them at the bottom. And the entire hive spilled out into this person's lounge, and they had tiny little sooty footprints, and their footprints just across the entire magnolia walls and cream carpet.
I had an interesting story recently. So basically Simon has left Lush now, and he's set up Carey's Secret Garden. Which is really lovely. And there, I was there not this spring, but the spring before, and this female honey buzzard arrived and sat on the tree looking at the roof where you'd taken out the, because you took out a load of bees from the roof.
We did have to take some from the roof of the Carey Secret Garden, and then there's Carey House, and in the roof of the house, there was quite a well kind of seasoned colony that had gradually did that thing where it moves from one roof frame to the next roof frame. So it filled up frame upon frame of the roof with bees, which was really interesting to look in. It wasn't only a small colony in there, but they'd really spread across the half of the roof.
Yeah. And so, and you'd taken that out, right?
Yep.
So then the honey buzzard, I thought, what's it doing sitting up there? It's a female. It just kept looking and looking and looking. It was very early in the season.
Grumpy, was it?
Well, I was thinking, I started to realise, oh, it's looking to where the bees were, but they're not there.
Yeah.
And so I developed this quite nice theory that this honey buzzard sat up there for 10 minutes looking for our bees. And then someone, but it was right over the pond. And then someone told me, no, that's not true. In the spring, they eat frogs.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And can you tell us a bit about your charity work?
Yeah, it's very kind of you to ask that. We have managed to give nearly £60 million.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I know. And I think that as well. I think.
Yeah, incredible.
You know, where I only had three hives and I could do the whole of the body shop with the three hives for one of the products. We've done well with that.
Amazing.
And it's basically gone to groups, you know, so fracking. Yeah. So Frack Off, for example. Mm. And you know, the nanas, I don't know if you know anything about the nanas, do you, against fracking?
Sure.
Oh, they're wonderful.
The nanas.
Yeah, they're from Lancashire, somewhere like that.
Oh, right. Yes, I have actually. Yeah.
The anti-fracking nanas, and they go do all these things, and they knit the whole time. I've got a blanket they knitted for my wife and I.
Sort of look disapproving.
Yes, that's right. They give you a hard look. So all those sort of groups. And they don't want a lot of money. I mean, most of the time, well, £5,000 about the most that anyone wants, perhaps 10. But in their case, it's just enough money for wool, I think. But, you know, that sort of supporting those groups, Hunt Sabs, those sort of groups that year upon year give their time and their effort to try to, often just to keep up the law. In the case of Hunt Sabs, they're trying to stop people fox hunting when it's against the law. Mm-hmm. It's been a real privilege and a pleasure to do that and an amazing thing. We do a lovely spring prize. You came up with that, didn't you?
Yeah, there was the anti-animal testing, fighting animal testing, which became the Lush Prize. And then we kind of did a mirror of that, which was kind of the spring prize, which was really focused on, I got really into permaculture and kind of regenerative agriculture and that side of things. So this whole world of regeneration, which are community groups that are hoping to kind of put back ecosystems and support one another and come up with these wonderful products and different things that we can potentially even source. Sometimes we source ingredients from. And that's become this lovely network of prize winners and participants, which is called the Spring Prize.
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant. People do like incentives, don't they? They like prizes. It gives them a reason to do something.
It's the education you get with it, because what happens to me is Simon comes and says, right, Dad, I think we should re-green the desert.
I love it.
Yeah, well, it sounds great, doesn't it? You know, it sounds great, but actually trying to do something like that is another thing, isn't it? And regeneration, I mean, the difference between just replacing what you had and actually improving. We've got this new slogan. It's not new. We've had it for a while, but it's leaving the world lusher than we found it. Mm-hmm. So constantly looking if you can leave something better than it was before.
Yeah.
Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, can you actually leave it better? Because all the other rules and all the other things don't somehow do that.
Mm. Yeah. Well, like we see, there's all this backpedaling all the time on stuff. And you're always constantly worrying about kind of whether regulations you put in or when you have you truly beaten animal testing. And, you know, there's kind of constant wash of, I think it feels a bit like it at the moment.
It does. Yeah.
Maybe going backwards on things that you thought were kind of solid and kind of there as your foundation to build things better. I think for me, like with regeneration and this sort of feeling of, it's just fitting in with what life does, but in a positive way, is kind of actually what's more life giving. It's why Carey's Secret Garden has been a lovely kind of almost like a lockdown project, 2 years of restoring a walled garden, because you're able to just gently add in bits that suddenly you do see your honeybees across all the lavender and the salvias and the apple trees. And you can see that bit by bit, you can actually improve and make things much nicer. And then other people join you in that. And you're like, wow, this is gradually and bit by bit is getting better and better.
You know, your marketing and, you know, it's so, you know, it just gives such a good message, I think, you know, about sustainability and, you know, and the use of all these wonderful natural products. And, you know, I know my children really were interested in that, you know, and
and what you're saying about this garden and you know, just it's the story of the product that I think is so important, how you can, you know, you can educate people as you go along. And I think you really do that, don't you, in your work? And I know that you've got this garden on top of Lush Castle, but it is, I don't know, I'm imagining it's the Lush building, but
why not?
You know, it'd be so nice. I mean, I know you've got the roof there, but just thinking about all this, you know, re-greening buildings, and how in some countries they've got so many balconies with, you know, with trees growing all up these buildings. I was just imagining, are you going to be pushing more of that with Lush on your rooftops?
Yeah, at the gardens, we've got about 7 hives that are nestled in the woods, actually.
Yeah.
That's where we're doing our beekeeping. The ones, the roof of Carey, the roof of Lush Castle, is so higgledy-piggledy and so complicated. It wasn't just bees. They had 6 different species of bat.
Yes, it's been a huge palaver.
He said the guy who put the planning application in, not that you want to know all that, but he said it was the most complicated thing he'd ever had to do.
One of the ideas we got, which had nothing to do with bees, is reintroducing Dalmatian pelicans into the Thames estuary.
Wow!
So how can you make the world lusher than you found it? Fairly simply. So that kind of thing is very much where I personally want to go. In Poole, we've already been part of reintroducing ospreys here, reintroducing seagulls, things of that nature. So that where you could really make a difference, really improve the quality of people's life. I mean, it's part of the beekeeping thing. Part of the reason it's lovely to do this is people who want to do this are doing their own small effort, aren't they? You know, they're in their garden with their bees. That to my mind, that's what it's all about. Mm. Every individual making that contribution in their own way.
I would say, I think for me, because telling the story is one thing, but then with Carey's Secret Garden, they actually, to be able to come and create spaces where you can actually see it done and connect truly, and actually, you know, whether it's beekeeping, whether it's fruit grown or whatever it might be, is actually having something kind of tactile and tangible and being a part of is also, I think, really exciting. So I found that, like, having people come to, because we're not far, we're down in Dorset, so we're not so far that people can't come down. And when they visit, the space itself, it does change. You know, when you talk about mental health and all of that, you're not talking about kind of something that is ethereal. You walk through the gates and you're like, oh, actually the tempo, everything changes. It's a walled garden, so it's perfect. You know, it's got a microclimate and it affects you as the individual in there.
But in my opinion, beekeeping is much the same, even if you're doing it in your own garden. You know, I don't know that we can, but when you get stung, it's not so good, is it?
No.
But otherwise, I do think that it's a very philosophical pursuit and very connected with all of these messages.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like Lush, your business is, who would have thought that you were going to have an empire of Lush? You know, it really is an incredible.
You don't look like the sort of people that might, do we, really?
If you think you do.
But it's amazing how, you know, we sometimes think things aren't changing, but there is change. And
yes,
people that have been coming to your shops for so long, they're the people who, you know, you've been teaching them something along this all the time.
They've also been teaching us. It's a very reciprocal thing.
I had that conversation at the weekend. We were talking about, we did a lot of work on palm oil for a long time.
Yes, yeah.
It's a completely different subject, but, you know, and I think the same when you look at shampoo bars or you look at any of these sort of topics that at first people are like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And to watch over a decade or 15 years or 25 years, I was talking to an orangutan organization, and now,
I thought you were going to say I was talking to an orangutan.
I could have been doing that too. That's completely possible. I'm a fan of that. Yeah, that kind of. But yeah, I mean, it was just that now you don't have, if you say to someone about Palmer like we've just done now, you all nod in agreement, knowing that, you know, we all know what that's about. And 5-10 years ago, we were still having to kind of talk a lot about these different issues. And then it's
so, like, you're using less palm oil, aren't you, in your products now? Yeah.
And it's a nuanced thing, because palm is, it's the same thing. Palm is itself, and it's the same with honey. You know, they're great ingredients. is how you produce them, what you do, the ethics of it, and all of this other stuff. And so for a long time, it was just way out of our league to do anything other than boycott it, really, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And not use it and remove it from stuff because we didn't have an option of doing it properly.
If you look at soap, when I first started being interested in making soap, soap was made from animal tallow. Mm. Yeah. So all the old, and you never knew if you went to a soap maker, because what happens, most soap guys like myself, we buy our soap made from a big generalist guy. In our case, a farmer in Yorkshire makes the base material. And then we turn that into various soaps. And so you would go to him and you'd say, I don't want any animal tallow. Well, we never know when we're going to switch it on and off. You know, we just do it by price. If the vegetable oil is cheaper, we do that. Well, I would like you to just use vegetable oil, please. And then eventually you get that going. And then slowly. But then, of course, the vegetable oil is palm oil. So then you've got to go back and say, look, excuse me.
And they roll their eyes a bit. Don't
What do you use as an alternative then?
The mixture of, I'm not sure where, sometimes it was coconut, rapeseed and sunflower.
For my favourite is the rapeseed.
And then it's a mixture of rapeseed and sunflower for a while, I think.
Were you part of the thing in Japan?
What, the Fukushima
stuff? Yeah. Is such a lovely project. So describe that with a...
So it's probably about 5 years ago. I went out and we've been supporting organic farmers who, in the aftermath of Fukushima and the nuclear disaster, had basically, they were the farmers who decided to stay on. So it used to be a really big organic farming kind of community. And they did a lot of different, from rice, potatoes, all sorts of different kind of agricultural produce. And then the disaster happened and that polluted all the topsoil. So you basically, they didn't know what to do. And they actually referenced Chernobyl. And they went, there was a kind of farming group in Chernobyl that said, oh, there's a few plants you can plant, sunflowers being one and rapeseed, canola being another. And they don't accumulate cesium into the seed. So basically the cesium, which is what's on the soil, which is radioactive, it goes into the plant, but it doesn't transfer into oil. So you can collect the seed, press it for oil, and the oil's clean. So basically they started, it's almost like a long-term, like you say, remediation. It's a long-term cleanup operation, which is to grow rapeseed. And we made a soap called Drop of Hope Soap, using rapeseed oil that we then made into this soap. And then we got to visit. And when you visited, you realized, you know, just how something like that is very different. It's not like an oil spill where you can see it and it's dirt everywhere. The landscape was pristine, but they then had gone along, you know, lovely rolling hills and forests. And then they'd had to remove all the topsoil from these different farms. They put them into big ton bags that you see, these sort of big hippo type bags, and put them into a car park. And that would then sit there for 35 years until they worked out how to clean that soil because it was so contaminated. Mm-hmm. If you took the wrong turning down a road, they would have a temporary barrier up because it wasn't every day that the radiation was in the same place. So what they had, it looked like dustbins in every car park, but they weren't. They were Geiger counters, basically. They would tell you the background radiation levels, and if they reached a certain level, you'd leave that area and you'd have to come back when it was safe. So it was a really surreal experience to be there, but to see that kind of, you know, how people were trying to adapt to this situation. I know it's not much to do with bees, but there is definitely
needed bees to pollinate the
it was what we're doing to these landscapes, whether it's spraying it with poisons or whether it's allowing radiation to leak all over it, and then how you get over that and how you kind of live with it. And some of those guys were incredibly brave. You know, they knew that it wouldn't, you know, they weren't going to last a long, long time doing it.
No, right.
How did you decide? I know, you know, you're not on social media and...
Yeah.
You know...
How did we decide not to do that?
Yeah.
The same way
I decided.
it's just simply that...
You forgot your login, didn't you?
Yeah. No, I mean, I was as addicted as everyone else to social media. There was no two ways about it. We tried to get off once, we went back on. And it's so easy to believe any of your ills are to do with not being, you know, like no sales or something, because you're not on social media. But the truth is, with some of them, where they were really they had research showing that young women thought of committing suicide when they'd been on. I think it was 14% of British women, 8% of American women. Mm-hmm. And that was their own research, which they hid, and then a whistleblower brought out. And we attract young women. That's our stocking trade. If we're on those social media channels, we're attracting them. And that is not appropriate. It's just not appropriate. It's not, if you know, once you know those figures, you think, well, you know, you wouldn't take people to a difficult spot to sell them a bath bomb. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, that's not right. So we've just come off, and we've managed to really come off this time. Last time it was a bit patchy, and it took me a long time to realize how, you know, Karen organized this meeting, and myself argued. And then I realized, so Karen, you're addicted to social media. And then, you know, then you think, well, so am I. And, you know, all the likes and the dopamine hits and all the rest of it. So anyway, I just stick to putting bird songs on Twitter now.
And finally, can you just tell us what your next big project is, if you have one? I'm sure you have.
Well, we always have projects within Lush. So, I mean, we're opening a lovely big store in Glasgow next, a really big one. And what we're doing is we're looking for lovely, for great communities, yeah, where we can open a larger store. So I rather think it'll be Belfast after that. But the other thing I'm really keen on doing is bringing back the House Sparrow to central London, the Cockney Sparrow Project. So I'm chatting to people about that.
What a lovely thing. That's gorgeous. Aww. Well, thank you so much for coming on and being our guest today. And I can't wait to go and get my bath bombs and shower everybody with Christmas bath bombs this year, which they are such a hit at Christmas. Well, all year round, but particularly at Christmas time.
Me too. I just can't imagine Christmas without bath bombs.
Thanks so much for sharing all your wonderful information. You've been a joy. Thank you so much. Thank you. Pleasure. Real pleasure.
Queen Bees is written and created by Esther Coles and Jane Horrocks. It is produced by Claire Broughton and Andy Goddard and partly recorded at The Hives on my allotment near Crouch End in London. Our title music is Sweet Nothing by Amy Mae Ellis and Will Cookson. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Queen Bees Pod for pictures and videos from the hive. Queen Bees is a hat trick podcast. It feels so good just to have you
around. Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.